Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast, your weekly update of World War II history with some lacrosse sprinkled in. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello.
Terry, I mean, we are the smartest historians ever. I had so much fun last episode, and this was my favorite. You mentioned it in an early episode, but this is one of my favorite weekends of the year, is who's getting into the semifinal, because the semifinals are a pretty universal experience, every team in the same location, and it's just, it doesn't get better than the Final Four. And combine that, I don't know what your social media feed looked like, but the graduation combined with the big lacrosse, combined with kids getting out of class, combined with all the excitement about moving forward. And let's not forget, I'm still just excited that it's nice outside. So there's still like the excitement and the buzz, like, ooh, I can go outside without wearing a parka. It just, all these things are aligning to make it one of the happiest times of the year. Join me in my happiness quest, because you might see a whole new Nick. Maybe the pessimism and the angst and the talk and smack might be out the window today. We don't know.
Positive spring, I think, is what we're talking about here. And I don't know, don't look now, but if it gives way to hot boy summer, look out. Brought to you by Second Slide.
I might have gained too much weight for hot boy summer. It might be like thick boy summer, and maybe wear a t-shirt in the pool summer so that you don't upset the children. But either way, I'm still having a good time. And I went on a hike yesterday, so watch out. Cardio levels are completely elite.
You said the word quest yesterday, and we're going to get to that momentarily, because I was in attendance at the sixth most heavily attended quarterfinal, I think, of all time, but certainly since 1996, when they went to the predetermined site format, and I believe all six or all five of the more highly attended quarterfinals were since 2007 or 2008 at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium, where, again, we'll get to this in a bit, but Kevin Corrigan talked about how his team has been on a quest since last May when they, I don't know if you heard, but they missed the NCAA tournament. But again, that is not what we are leading off with, because we are leading off with what, and I certainly hope you have an incredible, World War II pun packed in the chamber for this one. The craziest ending to a lacrosse game I can recall. So why don't you set the table? What did the weekend that was hold in store for our listeners?
So first off, I emptied the clip with all my World War II knowledge last week, so we're going to have to come up with something on the fly there. But Penn State Army was the game of the weekend and the wildest ending I can recall in recent memory. Rarely do you see a team storm the field in celebration twice, not even once, but twice. So this roller coaster of a finish in Penn State Army, we see Penn State go from a stinker of a year last year to now having officially clinched a Final Four spot, and I'm just going to call that the story of the year. I feel like there were a couple other contenders with Michigan, couple other contenders, but
Army.
Now that Penn State's clinched this, this program turnaround has been solidified as one of the best stories of the decade. I just love it. I love it. So this game, we'll talk about the ending in a second, but it was pretty close. Penn State jumped out to a lead, but could never really get that insurance goal that had Army giving up. And credit to Army for just, if there's one thing they're doing, they're resilient. They're going to keep storming. They're going to keep coming at you. And in a back-and-forth affair, Penn State was nursing a 3-4 goal lead, but Army keeps crawling their way back. And that final series was, I was screaming at the computer when I was watching it. So ground ball scrum, 10-9. Army gets it, shoots it, and with less than one second left, the shot's off. And it crosses the goal line, and we see Penn State celebrate. And I was curious to see Penn State celebrate, because I was like, guys, like, that very well might have gone in. Everybody stops. Everybody says, all right, the refs need to go check. And a friendly reminder that there's always like a quarter of a second to a half second lag of what you're seeing on the screen versus what's happening, in real time on the shot clock. So the refs had to go under the hood and say, we need to get this call right. We need to do justice by Army. Make sure that everything's squared away because we have a chance to, have an all-time screw job here. Credit to the refs. And Penn State went back and stormed what was not only a bit of a sloppy game, but I feel like one of the stories was anytime I see sloppiness at that elite level, I tend to fall back to, well, then it was just a good defensive performance. And Penn State, for all intents, was smothering Army's offense for a majority of the game. So for Army to mount the comeback, to me, was pretty surprising because they struggled to get offensive production, certainly in the first half, but with a sense of consistency across the entire game. So between Penn State's defense smothering, between some ridiculous series where I think someone tweeted out, I just want to watch Penn State and Army run ground ball drills for 2 hours in a row. That encapsulated both of these teams in the game where ground ball scrums just became heroic efforts. I can't remember the Penn State player, Terry, you're going to have to help me out here, where gets the ball, solo missions it across the entire field, gets it the loose ball in traffic, toe drags, runs up, and then coach calls the timeout and he goes over and is just gassed on the field. That's what this weekend is all about, is those sneaky individual efforts between the lines, those sneaky individual efforts on ground ball scrums. And this game was a beautiful mess every time the ball hit the ground because everybody was selling out. So between the sellouts, between the packed stadium, by the way, seeing a crazy packed engaged Army fan in Navy Stadium was a little interesting to me. I was like, that doesn't look right. There's something just a little different about Navy Memorial having a big Army crowd. The crowd, the ground balls, the individual efforts, the last second dramatics. This was far and away the game of the weekend. And credit to Penn State for putting together a good game plan to really limit Army's offensive production. Credit to Army to stay resilient. Two great stories, two great turnarounds, and the game of the weekend.
Yeah, so first shout out to Kevin Parnum, the defenseman that you're referring to, who carried the ball into the offensive end before getting that timeout and was just... As you said, I mean, it was definitely a war of attrition, certainly from the Penn State side. And I think that was an interesting element of the kind of the tactical storyline coming in. But, a couple things to add to your summary of the game. I mean, I think that, last week we had an interesting trend where the team that got out to the early lead ended up not winning in most of the instances in the first round. This week, I thought that we saw just incredible individual offensive performances be the reason that their team won, and otherwise the winning team kind of not having like great offensive days, probably less so for Virginia. Connor Schellenberger obviously had 10 points, but I felt that way about Duke. Brennan O'Neill had 6-1, and if it weren't for that, I think that could have been a very competitive game. And in this one, without TJ Malone's performance, particularly in the first half when they were building that lead, and I think you're right to call out, they had leads Penn State had leads of 6-2 and 7-3, but they never stretched. Well, okay, they had 6-2, 7-3, and then they scored the first goal of the third quarter after halftime to make it 8-3. And at that point, I actually felt like they had an opportunity to kind of separate. It felt like they had figured something out about the way in which, so I guess what I would say is TJ Malone's early goals, he had an incredible dive upfield where he avoided the crease altogether. And kind of continuing on in that vein, his goals in the second quarter, I thought were, pretty substantial individual efforts. But when he found space in the middle of the defense and took that pass from Jake Morin, to put Penn State up 8-3, that felt sustainable in a way that maybe some of the other goals that they had scored earlier in the game didn't. And so it felt like, even if Army was going to find their footing offensively, which they hadn't to that point, and I don't know that it was necessarily certain that they were going to, but even if they did, it felt like Penn State still had five or so more goals in them, and they'd be able to stretch this lead out, and at best, the game would come down to a 13-8 finish or something along those lines. No. Army's defense really settled in, and I think that the possession game completely shifted. And it's attributable to a lot of things, but whenever you talk about possession, you're always going to start, or you know, you're going to talk significantly about the faceoff game. And Will Colletti won 14 of 23 faceoffs and scored a goal. Like, that's just a tremendous, that's a tremendous day for a faceoff guy. In addition to that, he took three shots, which, you know, it's kind of funny because I think we can talk about this a little bit with respect to James Riley. Not all offensive possessions that a faceoff guy utilizes are created equally. Basically, if you're a faceoff guy and you shoot the ball over the end line and your team packs it up and you get to sub off, like, that's a totally live-withable thing. If you're a faceoff guy and you take a shot and it gets saved, you know, that's essentially a wasted possession, particularly if you're offense is otherwise able to score or playing well. Mm-hmm. So it felt like Army really controlled the last 20 minutes, and a couple of things happened. You know, obviously the storyline with Penn State's defense coming into this game was how effective their zone was against Princeton, and were they going to utilize it? And I think the first time they utilized the zone was with like 5 minutes to go in the third quarter. And Jeff Tamburini mentioned it after the game against Penn State, I'm sorry, against Princeton, that they felt like in their prior game, which was a Big Ten semifinal loss to Michigan, like they were chasing Michigan's Dodgers all over the field, and that's why they felt like they had to put in a zone in order to limit that. When you looked at Army's win over Maryland, we didn't talk a ton about individual dodging efforts. We talked about the effectiveness of their shooting. And when I talked to a handful of coaches who had prepared for Army over the course of this season and seasons prior, you know, they talked about how their quick sliding approach compelled Army to commit a lot of turnovers that they otherwise weren't making against Maryland and other teams. And I do think that there's a lot about a zone that shares a quick sliding approach in common. And so it's possible that, you know, that could have been Penn State's approach because they felt like they were going to compel a lot of those turnovers. But they didn't utilize it, and you can assume that the reason they didn't is because they weren't worried about Army's individual Dodgers getting space and winning their matchups against Penn State's defense. But then, middle of the second quarter, Jack Posey went down behind the cage with an apparent knee injury. He stayed down on the field, was tended to, walked off, didn't put any weight on the injured leg, went back into the locker room, was in the second quarter, had his leg wrapped with heavily with ice, and then was standing at the end of the bench without a jersey on. I believe came back out from halftime with a jersey on, but without arm pads and a helmet, and his leg was in a, you know, thigh to ankle brace. Jack Posey is their number one cover defenseman, and you know, you would assume is going would be the guy that would match up against Brandon O'Neill in their semifinal game against Duke. They don't have that luxury anymore. But what's interesting about, you know, I started this by mentioning Kevin Parnum was the player who carried the ball into the offensive end. He missed a substantial percentage of the first part of the season. And so Sam Sweeney, who then transitioned into a long stick midfielder role when he came back, was starting down low with Alex Ross and Kevin Parnum. And then when, Jack Posey, and then when Parnum came back, bumped back up to pull. So they do have a little bit more experienced depth down at that end. In addition to which they put Will Costin in, a freshman defenseman who played a fair amount in the fall as well. They rotated him in to get him some run in that second half too. And then, you know, they've been relying heavily on Ryan O'Connor as the LSM. So when you forecast it forward, not as damaging from the standpoint as it might be to another team from the standpoint of they've had four guys that have started games and played meaningful minutes so far this season. But at the same time, you know, there's a difference between, you know, Parnum and Posey from the standpoint of their role and what you expect them to do. And Posey, in my opinion, is a little bit less replaceable. So it'll be interesting to see how that parlays going forward. But as far as the fatigue element, because I think, you know, the broadcast made a big deal out of this, and I think that it was true, you know, it was 80 degrees, and most of these teams haven't played a game, if not many games at least, and certainly not in a recent amount of time, in 80-degree heat, much less having to do it on the back of losing a significant defensive piece. And so I think you started to see that with respect to how Army was able to find holes within Penn State. And like I said, they utilized a couple possessions of zone there late in the game and find success. And, you know, ultimately this came down to a one-goal game after, as we said, you know, Penn State's offense really slowed down. And what was crazy about that scrum that you talked about that led to Jacob Morin's final attempt on goal is that Army was man up. So they drew a foul. Basically, it was an unnecessary roughness that happened kind of bang bang with when a timeout was called. So they come out of the timeout in extra man, and it wasn't a well executed play with about 24 seconds left or so coming out of the timeout. And credit to Penn State, they did everything that they could or needed to do in order to keep that ball on the ground for exactly as long as it needed to be kept on the ground, except for the fact that with you mentioned it. I mean, Jacob Morin comes up with the ground ball with less than a second. The broadcast, I thought, was top-notch the entire day, specifically with the replays. And I thought this replay was the coup de grace. I thought, clearly showed that the ball was still in his stick with zeros on the clock and then was within 1/10 and maybe 2/10 of a second after that. The shot was released. It was an incredibly quick release. Like, I don't think this kid can have any regrets about what he did from the moment he picked up the ball to the moment it left his stick. I don't think that he could have done that any more quickly. And, I mean, it was a perfect shot. It was, like, between stick side hip and stick side high, and it just snuck inside the pipe. And, you know, clearly, Jack Fraxion is an excellent goalie, and he was standing there for, like, multiple seconds waiting for what exactly happened to happen. And when it finally did, he didn't really react. I mean, it was it surprised him. And that just speaks to the speed of the release. So you mentioned the sequence that unfolded, right? Army immediately goes crazy saying, this is a good goal. Penn State, I assume, heard the buzzer. And when you hear the buzzer and there isn't a goal awarded, you assume you win the game. They rush the field. I have become a very staunch opponent of video review. I think it has done more harm than good to sports.
Really?
Yeah. I am a big soccer fan, and the way in which it's called video-assisted review in, you know, FIFA and the Premier League. Yeah, exactly. The way in which drawing a square has ruined every goal celebration is bad. And then the things that basketball has done to speed up the game and make it more entertaining in the last 10 years have been completely offset by the length of the reviews that they run down the stretch. And then for football, the fact that even in the wake of video review, calls are still disputed, like 50% of the time. Exactly. It's like, what are we doing here? We're ruining the best experience of watching European football. We are undoing all of the gains made toward the biggest complaint in basketball, which is that the last 5 minutes of game take as long as the preceding 48 minutes or 43 minutes. And then with football, like, we're doing both of those things. We're reducing the drama of the big plays as well as the elongating the game, and we're still not getting the calls right. So it's funny. They use video review in the ACC women's tournament, and it was a gong show. There was a Boston College goal that was about, that was less than a minute before halftime. The official spent 8 minutes reviewing it. They then played like 40 seconds of game action and then went to a 50-minute halftime. I was like, you just take the 8-minute review out of the halftime, because these players will now have been sitting for essentially 23 minutes with 40 seconds of game action packed into it. So I say all that to say that was the perfect implementation of video review for lacrosse, and it was the closest thing that I can remember to one of the most dramatic sequences that we do get in basketball, which is, did the shot leave his fingers before time expired? And sometimes it did, and sometimes it didn't. We don't get buzzer beaters very often in lacrosse, and it would obviously have been more dramatic if it had counted and it had gone to overtime, but still, to have it not count was about as drama-filled as it could have been. So, unbelievable game. I mean, you and I texted you in the middle of the third quarter. It was probably right after that goal to score, to go up 8-3. And I was like, man, our podcast is going to be like 8 minutes tomorrow because this is boring, right? I mean, the first two games on Saturday and this game didn't live up to the five really good games that we had in the first round in terms of drama. And then, you know, the last third of the Army-Penn State game really delivered. And I thought that the Notre Dame-Hopkins game, you know, despite the fact that it wasn't a one-goal game down the stretch, was still very dramatic. And we've got a lot to talk about with that one, too.
Yeah. So, ton to respond to there. The first is, like, thawing out over the spring is a very real... Whether you call it an issue or whether you call it, like, there's nothing you can do to prepare for that. Like, when it's cold and it's freezing and then all of a sudden you find yourself, especially there were some days in South Bend where you just go the long winters. I feel like it was just a long winter across the country this year. And you go from playing snow games in mid-April to now you're playing 80 degrees on turf in Annapolis with humidity. That's a very, very real thing. Not only do you have to do more hydration, but when you sweat, it wears down the jersey, and then now the jersey's heavier, and then now your legs are becoming jelly. And I think that did play into Army, because anytime you play a service academy, you're like, okay, I don't care what it is in the fourth quarter, they're going to out-condition us. Like, every time we would get ready to scrimmage Air Force, every time we would have to play a service academy, we would jump out to an early lead, and then over the course of the next four quarters, it just would very much be they would wear us down. And I think that was a good representation of the game. And I think this Annapolis venue is just perfect for that. You know, having Army stage a comeback because no one can out-condition Army. The dramatics of it also. I think you're 100% right to call out that. And the broadcast, I got to say, the broadcast, rarely do I notice, wow, that was really good from a review and a replay standpoint. I saw a number of comments about that where they're like, these replays are just dialed. So good job by the production team on that point. And so the thaw is very real. I'm extremely excited to see how that's going to play out and what the weather looks like this, this upcoming weekend, because it creeps up into the 90s. That's going to have an effect on the team. And I'm curious to see, who was working hard enough in January to try and mitigate those efforts enough. The second point, and you said a lot, and my brain is stupid, so I'm going to have to try and really remember. But it's interesting that Penn State's running the zone and has depth. And I think that from a game plan standpoint, it's more kind of annoying than it is anything else. So when you're an offense preparing to go against the zone, 99% of the times you're licking your chops, because if you have the players and someone's preparing a zone against you, you're like, well, they've mailed it in. And if someone's running a zone, and granted, I'm going to reflect a little bit on my college days, we'd get ready and someone, I can't remember who ran a zone on us, and we're like, okay, hey, Sergio Perkovic, get ready to have a fun day, man, because someone's running a zone and you have to be an idiot. And I think Duke has the outside shooters, but it does just take enough time away in the preparation to maybe have some shortcomings in other areas where, oh, we could have maybe dialed in some of our other offensive sets, kind of some of the stuff that we're used to, but we had to spend, 2 to 3 hours over the course of the week of that valuable time getting ready for a stupid zone. Now, to contrast that, we talked at the open about how it's graduation week. Right now, most kids aren't in class. They're not doing anything else. So you have more time to spend on the lacrosse field because hopefully your finals are over. So as far as preparing for a zone, yeah, you have to spend more time on it, but you have more time to spend, which I think ends up playing in Duke's favor in a number of ways, not only because they have the players and the outside shooters to beat any zone that's thrown at them, but they have more time to game plan post-graduation than they would have last week. And then the final point is, I agree with you. I think that, and I hate to agree with you because, for a number of reasons, video replay needs to be put. We need to call up Elon Musk and say, I need to borrow your rocket and we need to send video replay and fire a nuclear bomb it into the sun. Nothing worse than refs that, you know what? My wife didn't give me enough attention this week. My life is a mess. You know what we could do? We could spend 8 minutes on a replay in the ACC tournament, something like that. So I think you're right to call out a lot of that. I think it was by far the game of the weekend. I mean, just
I've got one more thing to say about this game, which is
go say it then. Say it to chest.
What do you think is the most? What do you think is the best rule that the PLL has come up with?
It's tough to not go right to the shot clock, like the shorter shot clock. I'm a big fan of box lacrosse because every offensive possession, like you can't just waste time. You have to go down and do something effective with it. So a 52-second shot clock, I think that's what it is.
It is 52 seconds, but I also don't think that they – I mean, so they get credit for 52 seconds, but they don't get credit for a shot clock because that pre-existed PLL.
Yeah, no, the shorter shot clock –
Let me just say, you were supposed to say no timeouts in overtime, because that's the joke. But in reality, the ability to play after you break your stick without a stick. Because can you imagine losing a game by one when you gave up a broken stick goal?
No, that's one of the all-time stupid rules in lacrosse. Like, so... That's a great call out. I was going to just say shot clock because that inherently speeds up possessions, and I feel like the broken stick, you can still play. One of the big things about me not bringing that up is I forgot about that. So credit to you. So
yeah,
me on the spot.
I'm sure that there was a pivotal World War II battle that I don't know, the Nazis. Heavy artillery malfunctioned, and we can make a comparison there. Or, you know, they shot their shot after time expired. I don't know what the right. Actually, you know what, the shooting of the shot after time expired really should should be the shot heard around the, well, that's World War One, but also the shot that started the Revolutionary War in Concord, Mass. That's what we're gonna go.
The shot heard around the world needed a video review back in the day, and then they would have gone, oh hey, sorry fellas, that was after time expired. You guys, let's take it easy. So,
hey Nick, where'd you go to college?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked, Terry, and I'm so humble about it, and I don't like to talk about it too much. But this is a lacrosse podcast, and I played football in college, but I played lacrosse in college too. And how you doing? After getting blackballed last year, I'm still not over it. Notre Dame advances to the first Final Four since when, Terrence?
2015. Shocking.
2015. And here's some insight. I sent it to you. But so Quint Kesnick called this the best Notre Dame team ever. He was wrong because my dad texted me and said, I'm just going to read it and I might have to do some self, you know, just edit it. But the best team ND ever had. My dad says, I disagree with the fine Quint Kesnick. Your senior year was the best, in my humble opinion. Also, you and Neer just got an ESPN shout-out. So, thank you, Steve Osello, for the hard-hitting analysis. But moving to this Notre Dame game.
Hold on. That's not all you sent. And by the way, you did warn the world against screenshotting text message exchanges and sharing them.
That's a box that I don't know if you want opened because... Just screenshotting texts in general, regardless of context, is a dangerous game. And again, I say you don't want open, but I really think it would be worse for me. So anyways, what were you going to say?
That I've never heard the expression, Philly bound, UVA can take a suck. I don't know if that's what he was going for or if that was just too... thoughts that collided in his brain and it turned into one expression, but either way, I'm here for it.
I've been hearing that about two times a day since I gained consciousness. Take a suck. That's the big saying in the household. So so shout out Steve Osello. 2015 was the best Notre Dame team. And that's unbiased, by the way. There's no way there's bias slipped into that. And UVA can, quote-unquote, take a suck. That one's free. Next one's going to cost you. All right, let's talk about the game here. Let's talk a little bit about the game. So you mentioned it in the article, but 4.5 goal underdogs. And that's pretty significant. And I feel like this was yet another game that was semi-defined by individual performances. It was neither team's offense really getting into the routine, the swing of things. And again, shout out another team in Hopkins who, by the way, I just love to dog on Twitter. I think people hate Hopkins, or people think I hate Hopkins more than I actually do, but it's too fun to mess with their fan base. So, this game felt to me like Notre Dame having the complete package and the talent across the roster to, when they're out of their comfort zone and what they can normally do, they can create opportunities and they can manufacture opportunities with their talent across the board. And I think that's emphasized by Pat Kavanaugh being relatively quiet with no goals and an assist. So who steps up? Chris Kavanaugh and Jack Simmons with 3 goals apiece. I think they both had an assist, and Eneman made 10 saves. So this game to me felt more like a run and gun. You have to find ways to score goals. You have to have opportunities when they present themselves, and you have to manufacture them individually. And so that led itself to an interesting arc over the course of the game where Notre Dame jumped out to a lead. And just like you were mentioning, I think it was 7-4 at half, where there wasn't that proverbial nail in the coffin at any point. Hopkins always felt like they could come back, and the talented Hopkins roster, again, they created opportunities individually, whether it was Melendez, Degnan, and those are the only two players Collison. I ever remember from Hopkins.
Collison.
No, just those two. Okay. Nope. And then the final stat was just generally speaking offensive efficiency, and the hole I would say that Notre Dame has is possession. Hopkins outpossessed Notre Dame. They had the face-off battle, but shout out to Notre Dame's defense for having limiting Hopkins' offensive efficiency to where every possession kind of felt like a battle, felt like a grind, making them earn everything that they have. And Notre Dame was able to convert on less possessions as opposed to Hopkins not being able to convert on more possessions. And the arc of the game, it was semi-dramatic, but it never really felt like a huge danger to Notre Dame that they were going to lose. Do you agree or do you disagree? Also, what are your thoughts on Anish calling me an elite two-way midi? It's not about me, but let's just go over that real quick.
I mean, I think that's a vast overstatement. I think that we established you as you're pretty good. What was it? Are you fine or are you pretty good? I'm pretty sure it was in the headline of one of these podcast episodes in the past, so should be pretty quick to find. I'm going
to
stick. Well,
do you
want
to listen to Message Boards or do you want to listen to ESPN? Yeah, it was Osello's never a great. He was a pretty good, if anything, I think. But if I remember the quote correctly, it said, "Wow, not only was Nick Osello one of the best two-way middies, but also he's very handsome and." I want to say something else, but again, we're a family-friendly podcast.
Don't say it.
And
don't say
to the FCC, you can take a suck. So, all right, back to you.
So, all right, I am going to suspend my Terry Foy typical humility thing here for a second and adopt a little bit more of Nick pretty good Osello attitude toward...
you nailed it.
Toward analysis. Well, thank you for saying that because I actually do think that I had the way in which Hopkins was going to be able to win this game if they were going to be able to win it pretty well dialed in. So here's the story, right? I think that I have been higher on Hopkins than a lot of other analysts or fans or whatever for all of the last 3 years, and specifically was of the opinion that it was going to manifest in wins and losses this season, heading into this season. And it was a function less of, like, I wrote in my top 20, because I had him at like 21 or 22 prior to the season, that they were going to be better, or if they were going to be better, it was going to be based essentially on vibes as opposed to talent. And, like, the point was that losing a number one recruit in Joey Epstein and a number three or four recruit in Connor DeSimone and replacing them ostensibly with a Marquette transfer who hadn't really gotten out of the field and a freshman midi who was an Under Armour All-American and really good, but not you know, a top five recruit, was like going to be a net negative, but they were going to more than make up for it through the adaptation of like a system that I think Pete Milliman demonstrated the capacity to create in at Cornell, and then also now bolstered by John Corrales' arrival and their symbiosis in terms of the way in which they were just, you know, kind of creating a culture. And I saw it when I went to practice in the fall, and that was largely what I was basing my opinion on. So anyhow, I picked Notre Dame in my like bracket, both in terms of winning this game and winning the national championship. But in our staff picks, I came into the weekend trailing Kevin Brown by 3 games. So I needed to pick differently from him in order to potentially be able to catch him. So I picked Hopkins, and then we decided to do an article about it, like justify your picks. Like, how did this, you know, how does this happen? And I started to, I was like, all right, I'll take Hopkins. And I sat down and I was just like, I don't really know how they're going to win. And so I put a lot of thought into it. And basically, like, what I concluded was, you know, if they're going to win, it's going to have to be like a 13-12 or 12-11 type game. And when you analyze how has Notre Dame been limited to goal totals like that over the course of the season, you know, it's really only been Virginia who has done it. And, you know, I think that the first and second Virginia games were actually pretty different. So I didn't necessarily think that there was much to glean from that. And not only that, but also, you know, the Virginia Hopkins game was really one-sided and a game that was decided, you know, in the second quarter, if memory serves. So, you know, I kind of like built my thought from the ground up. I was like, well, so I do think they're going to have a face-off advantage. I didn't expect them to get to 66%, but they did. So, you know, credit to Matt Narewski for the job that he did there. I felt like they were going to have to be perfect, clearing the ball and in some of the other areas of the game, and they weren't. And ultimately, I think that's why they lost. But we'll come back to that. Felt like Scott Smith was going to be challenged with guarding Pat Kavanaugh. And basically, like, what I envisioned was, you know, the staff saying to him, nobody on this team has been around for the entirety of this development arc to the and been as important to us as you have been. You know, Garrett Dagnon also, but kind of set that aside for the purposes of this conversation. Like, our ability to win this game is going to hinge on your ability to limit Pat Kavanaugh. And I think he did that. And I think that they created a defensive game plan that allowed him to be very focused on that matchup. And, you know, I think that Alex Mazzone is a top five defenseman in college lacrosse because of a combination of his ability to pick off passes, pick up ground balls in traffic, leg out clears to get, you know, safely into offensive possessions. And just remain focused for 60 minutes. And I was like, that is the skill set I want deployed on Jake Taylor. Is it a waste? Can you guard him with a short stick? Potentially, but not with a same matchup on every play. And so that was what I thought you were potentially sacrificing. And then Bowden Zulik, I thought, was, from a physical standpoint, a good matchup against Chris Kavanaugh. Chris Kavanaugh won that matchup both emotionally and on the score sheet. And that was a huge part of it. Hopkins double pulled a lot of possessions. Ultimately, like, I can do kind of the same matchup thing at the other end of the field, and I will a little bit. But what I realized was these are two of the least matchup conscious teams, with the exception of how frequently Scott Smith stayed on Pat Kavanaugh throughout the game. I mean, you saw a lot of quick switching when, you know, picks were set. So, point being, from a defensive standpoint, they held Notre Dame to 12 goals. They obviously stifled possessions. Notre Dame only finished with 30 possessions on the game, and they scored on 12 of them. So 40% conversion, that's really good. That's good efficiency. Hopkins didn't get a great game from Tim Marcille. He made 3 saves in the first quarter, and I think that helped prevent that kind of avalanche effect that could have happened early and kept them in the game. But he only made 1 save per quarter as the game went on. And they obviously would have needed one or two more, particularly down the stretch, in order to win the game. But I do think that, you know, to the extent that either end of the field lost the game, it was the offensive end. And specifically, I think it was the offense in the second quarter. This game was tied 4-4 with 14 minutes to go in the second quarter. And you mentioned that Notre Dame took a 7-4 lead into the half. Hopkins went 10 minutes without getting a shot off between the 14-minute mark and the 4-minute mark of the second quarter. And again, I think that's kind of that was the pivotal moment when they lost the game. And it was a function of a combination of turnovers, and I think they had two or three shot clock violations in that possession in that sequence. And you know, it was interesting. So my thought in terms of what Hopkins was going to need to do in order to get to 12 or 13 goals, which is what I identified they were going to have to do in order to win, I didn't see a scenario in which they could win this game 15-14 or 16-15. I thought Notre Dame's defense and defensive game plan and Liam Entenmann was going to be too strong. You know, and Entenmann gobbled up some shots early in this game and demonstrated to me that, you know, it wasn't going to be realistic for Notre Dame to, or I'm sorry, for Hopkins to expect to get cheaper, easy goals. You know, he made 10 saves and they scored 9 goals, so he was over 50%. So good day from Liam Entenmann, but I don't think that over the balance of the subsequent three quarters, he was as kind of outstanding or meaningful as he was early in the game, which is appropriate, at least insofar as Hopkins got a similar performance out of their goalie from a, you know, how the game went along standpoint. For me, and I think this will be interesting in the context of how they prepare to guard Virginia, it's demonstrable the gap between the effectiveness of the player that Chris Fake is guarding relative to the effectiveness of the player that the other two close defensemen, Chris Conlon and Marco Napolitano, are guarding. Notre Dame made the decision to start Fake on Jacob Angeles and Conlon on Russell Melendez and Napolitano on Degnan. Melendez and Degnan both got 2 goals. Angeles got 1 assist early, and it was an interesting play where he was sweeping topside from the high wing, and Fake went underneath the screen. Angeles took the extra space in order to find Collison in the shooting slot. I believe it was Collison for a relatively easy goal. And I felt like after that, he was pretty invisible. They didn't go back to it. They didn't try to force the matchup. And I really do think that Hopkins' offense doesn't hum unless Angeles is really facilitating well. And so, you know, in terms of the balance of the game, they really relied on a lot of, you know, individual efforts, guys beating their man and getting shots off. And, you know, I thought that there were a couple of sequences throughout the game. This was a contest late. Notre Dame opened an 11-6. Well, Notre Dame opened an 11-6 lead, and then Hopkins scored twice to make it 11-8. At that point, you know, it was pretty clear if they get one more, this is going to be a tense finish. And they had an opportunity to do so. They took a shot in transition and then subbed, and Brennan Grimes took a bombing, sweeping left-hander out of the box, a zero-pass possession, or at least after the original transition shot. You know, I thought that was an instance where, like, that's not Hopkins. That's not their offense. And they were taken out of their game a little bit over the course of the game. And Degnan said that post-game, he thought that they rushed a little bit, and that was one of their big problems. So, yeah, I mean, it was a... Then ultimately, Notre Dame comes down, calls timeout. Coming out of the timeout, they double with, I believe, Melendez and Smith and Chris Kavanaugh splits the double and scores the icing goal. Hopkins got one back to set the final score at 12-9, but it never got any closer than that. So I guess my point is, more than anything else, really interesting chess match. And I thought that, you know, with the exception of their turnovers, despite the fact that they committed 2 fewer turnovers than Notre Dame, Hopkins did pretty much everything they needed to do in order to win the game. The game flowed the way that it needed to flow in order to win the game. They just made too many mistakes, didn't make quite enough saves, and some of those mistakes were inclusive of not getting into their offense and their offensive identity. And that netted the result because Notre Dame was more talented, right? That's why they were 4.5 goal favorites. Basically, what I'm saying is that, like, games need to flow a certain way typically in order for underdogs to win. And this game flowed in a way that was necessary for Hopkins to win. But what was interesting is I kind of flip-flopped in the first half between Hopkins can stay in this game and Notre Dame is too talented, they're just going to pull away. And I still believe that even if Hopkins had gotten it to 1 or 2 goals, Notre Dame would have won because I don't think they ever really got out of fourth gear because they never really felt threatened. I do think that they had more gas in the tank, so to speak, if they had been pressed. But it was at the very least enough to make it a really compelling game.
Yeah, I mean, so you mentioned it being relatively exciting with Hopkins kind of scoring those back-to-back goals in a minute. I think that was for the theatrics of it, where Kevin Corrigan was like, hey guys, our Notre Dame fans came all the way out here. Let them score too quick before we just don't let them. So I think that was intentional. Obviously, I'm being an idiot. The one thing and a big takeaway from this game for me was I don't like how this game played out and planned out because of the next round opponent, because of Virginia. And in a game where you have to manufacture goals, I don't think anybody on planet Earth is going to out-manufacture what Virginia is able to do. So as far as what I was looking for this game from like a Notre Dame fan standpoint was a good game plan, hyper-effective offense, controlling more possessions, not really getting into a run-and-gun slash individual matchup type situation. And, you know, kind of whether it's credit to Hopkins or whether it's, you know, Notre Dame not wanting to try and force too many things, I feel like Hopkins did a better job of trying to get a little bit out of that team, like make it more of an individual, make it more of, that type of game. And I say manufacture, and I don't just mean in transition. I kind of mean, all right, well, the initial play didn't work and the game plan that we drew up isn't being effective. So it kind of ends up being a run and gun, semi unstructured offense, I guess might be a little bit better of a term. And I don't know. I just, that type of game scares me heading into Virginia, which we'll talk about in a second.
Well, why don't we just transition to talk about those, unless you have any more points on this game. I think it makes sense to talk about these in conjunction with another. So if you want to get going on Virginia Georgetown, now would be the time.
Okay. I had one more point and I forgot what it was.
Perfect.
I think it was just to go back to my classic personality. Hopkins, wow, you guys looked really good. Hope you wear those jerseys on the golf course. If you're a Hopkins fan listening, suck it. Take a suck. Okay. Got that out of the way.
Glad you got that one in.
We're going to have to go back to the replay to see if that under the belt shot was right before the bell rung. It was nature's healing. Notre Dame's defense leads them to a Final Four and stop. So the next game, Virginia Georgetown, I would say was the most overall entertaining from start to finish game by far. I think the moment of the weekend obviously was Penn State Army, but this game was a beautiful train wreck of goals and everything that you would want to see. And that started, I think Virginia scored in 1 second off the opening faceoff. And I think the second goal came 2 seconds in. So literally you go up, you go to crack a fresh Dr. Pepper because we're a family friendly show. You come back and Virginia's up 2-0 and you go, okay, this is game over. But Georgetown, I mean, credit to them and their offensive production. I mean, I couldn't believe the amount of goals, whether it was coming from Tucker Dordovic, whether it was coming from good ball movement, whether it was coming from like good shot placement. It just became this back and forth punch fest of Virginia, you know, inching their way forward, Georgetown catching up. And then it just became tight, tight, tight. The fascinating part and why I think Virginia is such a lethal opponent, and we've talked about it, we've tweeted about it, their ability to score late in the shot clock off of unsettled things like backdoor cuts, off of individual efforts. And they're a team that, you know, every team that's good enough, eventually someone says, you can't make mistakes because they'll take advantage of it. To an extent, Virginia, you don't even have to make that big of a mistake. Like the back cut that I'm thinking about, it was half a second with 4 seconds left on the shot clock. That could happen to any defenseman anywhere. So final score was 17-14. And in a game that felt like Georgetown did everything that they could do, to me, it ended up being Virginia's ability to just find those 2 second lapses in judgment, or not even lapses in judgment, that 2 second, you know, little mini hole where you just have to throw the perfect pass. You have to catch it. Their stick skills on ridiculous display. So credit to Georgetown for a great season. Again, I'll apologize one last time for completely writing you off and talking smack about you behind your back after the first three losses. A valiant effort against Virginia, but Schellenberger and company are just too skilled, too good, and take advantage of any mistake better than any team in the country.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where your point about being concerned from and manufacturing goals standpoint is about keeping pace, right? You know, this notion that because and you know you tweeted during the game that their end of shot clock execution was so dangerous, so scary. You know, I tweeted that I thought that their ability to manipulate and get open looks in the sub game, like it's essentially what we're talking about is goals that don't come in normal situations. And the point is that Virginia is going to score efficiently enough and frequently enough in normal situations that defenses can't allow to give up goals outside of those normal situations. They are unduly disheartening. And I guess my question or my thought is, you know, it's kind of the inverse of the point that I just made about the Hopkins-Notre Dame game. What is the margin and what is the roadmap for Notre Dame to beat Virginia on the basis of a combination of what we just saw the Cavaliers do against Georgetown and how what UVA saw Notre Dame do or struggle to do against Hopkins, how is that going to manifest in a semifinal matchup? And I guess my point would be you got to take a little bit from each margin. And so what that means is, you know, you have to be 5% more efficient in settled sets, which means roughly 1.5 to 2 fewer goals. So that takes them from, you know, let's say 16 to 14. And then you basically, if they average 2.5 goals per game in those, you know, crazy substitution situations or scoring off the faceoff or whatever like that, you got to take that down to, you know, 2 to 1.5 goals, right? So that takes it from 16 to, let's say, 13 to 13.5. And then you got to do the same thing in terms of late shot clock effectiveness. You know, and you got to convert what would be a goal against Georgetown or Richmond in a late shot clock situation into a shot clock violation, which is a cousin of playing good, settled defense. But my point is that, like, I don't know if you feel the same way, but Virginia has held Notre Dame to 12 goals and 8 goals in 2 meetings this year. It seems like it would be unrealistic to expect Notre Dame to get beyond 13, which means that if you're drawing a map for how Notre Dame is going to beat Virginia, it probably has to start from, like, essentially holding Virginia to 13 goals or 12 goals. And that's a really daunting task. And it comes from a number of places, not just your defensive performance, but it also comes from the faceoff, right? So, you know, Pete LaSala is a historically good faceoff guy. This is going to sound a little bit like a hot take, and it's an interesting conversation, I think.
I'll alert the police.
So, you know, he directly led to the first 2 goals of the game and an incredible tone setter, and it was awesome. We've complimented the broadcast. On Sunday, the replays were excellent. I thought that, and I know that there's kind of like a split opinion on this, so whatever. I thought that the way they got tight on faceoffs, particularly when it was a tie-up and the ball was still at both guys' feet, I thought that I wanted to see more out of Pete LaSala's fight in those situations. And, you know, Georgetown effectively got to 50%. James Riley is a really good faceoff guy who injured his hamstring 2 weeks ago and didn't have the season in 2023 that he had had in prior years. You know, Pete LaSala is an All-American for a variety of reasons. The fact that he takes 400 faceoffs is one of them. The fact that he is really effective offensively is another reason. But I do think that there's like a downside to both of those things, which is that, you know, in the normal course of facing off, like there are instances in which he is more gettable than he would be if he was not taking every face off or not, you know, contributing offensively and exerting a lot of energy in order to do that. So the point is that while Hopkins got to 66% against Will Lynch, you know, maybe Will Lynch can get to 45% or 48% against Petey LaSala, and really reduce that possession advantage that Virginia might expect by virtue of their ride and LaSala's effectiveness, you know, down to essentially the manageable number that we're going to need to see in order to realistically effectively limit them to 13 goals, which is probably about 30 possessions. So it's basically, from a math problem standpoint, roughly what Hopkins had to do. So then you got to look at the other element, which is you got to be perfect clearing the ball, which Notre Dame is a very good clearing team. I believe they were number five this year at like 91%. And then you got to use the shot clock a little bit more. And I don't think that they're a team that necessarily plays fast offensively. So it's not taking them out of what they do well in order to do it. But at the same time, like, what is the risk or what is the downside of being okay with going a little bit away from what your DNA is in order to limit how frequently Virginia is getting the ball and what type of pressure they're putting on your defense? And that's where you really hone in on how Notre Dame is effective offensively or has been effective offensively and why Virginia has been more effective limiting them than anything else. And, you know, one of the things that we were discussing in the press box, and a lot of people that know Notre Dame very well were affirming, is the fact that you've got a guy who's 6'7" and a guy who is 6'5" guarding two players who are like 5'11". You know, Pat Kavanaugh is probably what, 6 foot, between 5'11 and 6 foot, and Chris is 5'10". So just in terms of that size advantage, you're creating a reach problem, you're creating a passing lane problem, you know, you're creating a open space problem, and typically their craftiness and their you know, the things that make them so special go a long way toward that. But then you wonder, cumulative effect-wise, does the amount of energy they need to do in order to get the same look against Cole Kastner or Cade Sostad compared to what they have to do in order to get that exact same look against Kenny Brower and Wilson Stevenson or Keith Boyer, does it come at the expense of the energy they're able to then a lot like use on the ride, right? And so are you not getting those second-chance opportunities that they are... I mean, I don't know if this was a stat that somebody looked up or if it was just a guess, but I think, and I can't remember whether it was on the broadcast or something else that I heard, read, or spoke about this week, because it's quarterfinal week and I was inundated with content. But so I heard that Notre Dame scores on more than 70% of their second chance possessions. And of their 12 goals, six of them against Hopkins came after either a shot clock reset, which is a rebound, a second chance opportunity, or immediately off of a Hopkins turnover, some of them caused, some of them uncaused, not counting shot clock violations. I didn't include that because that's just a different thing, right? A shot clock violation is good defense. A Hopkins turnover is, and there were a couple instances where they scored two possessions off of, you know, so for instance, like there were two faceoffs where Jack Holley came up with the ground ball and got dispossessed, got stripped. And one of those instances at least led directly to a goal, and the other one led to a goal two possessions later. So it's just like, in terms of how clean Hopkins needed to play in order to beat Notre Dame, like they just fell short. And it'll be interesting again to see, you know, is Notre Dame able to do the things in terms of earning those second chance possessions against Virginia that further allows them to tip the possession scale, specifically from a time of possession standpoint, and then also give them those opportunities to score at the accelerated rate that they are known for scoring.
Well, and it's a dangerous double-edged sword, and it's a dangerous game to start thinking, all right, let's try to take more and chew up more of the clock on offense. Because, you know, over the course of the year, Notre Dame's offense has settled into a rhythm. Everybody's kind of on the same page, and this isn't just specific to Notre Dame. This is every single college team. And a big part of establishing a rhythm is everybody being on the same page of, you know, kind of just like the mental connection, the telekinesis of, okay, this is going to be a good scoring opportunity because the right pieces are in place. This guy's dodging. The backside guys are in the right spot. Normally, this is going to result in something. You start throwing in, all right, guys, let's take more of a let's take more of a slow approach. I think that has two negative repercussions, or the potential for two negative repercussions. One, no flow of the offense, where you're not quite sure if we're going to be initiating. In the back of your mind, we're like, all right, we need to, you know, kill a little bit more time and make sure that we're taking advantage of this whole possession. So throwing off rhythm and balance a little bit. And then the second part is, you know, lacrosse, even thinking about like coaching lacrosse, right? Trying to run up a play and drop a play where the end result is a shot in a specific location, I think is stupid, because a lot of times you're more just breaking the defense down and then taking advantage of wherever their shortcomings are. So, you know, barring end of game drawing up plays, you're just running motions to break down defense, and it's up to the IQ of the players and the you know, ability of the players to find that backside pass, to find the crease, to find the shot, because it could come in a number of different ways. And when you're being more patient, it gives you less opportunity over the course of the possession to break down the defense. So I don't like this matchup. I hate it. Obviously, Virginia's won the twice, but you know, it's good to know that going into this game, there have been those situations where it's like, okay, we can put a bigger premium on focusing on this. And I think this meaning the last 10 seconds of a shot clock, make sure that you're locked up. Like, make sure that you're locking up your guy. No BS off of that. And then I'm extremely excited to see how the faceoff game plays out. You know, the aggression and tenacity in which, even if there is a possession, making sure that LaSalle doesn't just go down feed Schellenberger for a goal. Making sure that you can throw out and do some interesting counters. And maybe throw in the 10-man. I mean, I miss the Notre Dame 10-man ride. I want to see a big, you know, gong show of, well, what are we going to do to put Virginia on their heels? Let's throw in a 10-man in the first quarter and just see how they react to it. So I don't know, Terry. I'm a little scared. I admit it. Hand up. But
all right. Well, let's allay some of that fear by talking about the last game of the weekend.
Okay. So Duke and Michigan. Duke just ends up winning is really the story. I mean,
the score was 15-8 for those of you that don't know.
Yep, 15-8 and semi-close game if it weren't for Brendan O'Neill. And this was a Brendan O'Neill show, and he's been talked about all year. He's been, you know, touted as one of the best. But this was really
depending on who
you are. Or a bust by, you know, if you're a complete idiot. What a loser that guy is. Or girl, I don't know. Don't know. Anonymous burner accounts. But this game to me just felt like his, okay, when I want to win a game, I can just come out and win a game. And the two things that stick out to me about him, one, everybody was going like, oh, this is crazy because he got his guy to 5-5 and threw it behind the back. Like, that's an unstoppable. It was like a left-handed version of what we've seen Joey Spallina do, if you're picturing that. If you're listening to this, you probably saw that goal. The goal that impressed me more was his on-the-run righty down the alley high heat shot. Like, it's frustrating to see that, because how do you stop this guy? You have to slide early, but now he has, you know, he's been able to feed and create opportunities anytime he has the ball. So honestly, to me, maybe you can give more insight, but it was a lot of players and then Brendan O'Neill deciding that he was going to score six. And there wasn't a whole hell of a lot that Michigan could do to stop it, because he scored posting up at 5-5 on the run, outside, inside. It's just, it was a complete game by him, and Michigan just didn't have, you know, talk about individual performances. This was the individual performance of the weekend, in my opinion. Schellenberger had more points, but Brendan O'Neill had a bigger individual impact, just deciding that he's going to do things that nobody else in the country can do.
Yeah. So I would actually say that there are elements of this game that are similar to the Notre Dame-Hopkins game, even though the margin ended up being bigger and you know, all that sort of stuff. From the standpoint of, you know, really the outcome more than anything else was determined by Michigan's logo total. And you can start by saying how much of that is attributable to Michigan offense playing poorly, how much of it's attributable to Duke defense playing well, and how much of it is attributable to their goalie Wilhelm making saves that he shouldn't have made, or you know, went beyond whatever would have been reasonable to expect from him. He finished with 14 saves and 8 goals allowed. And I struggle with it because Michigan scored, let's see. So they scored a garbage goal late. So it was really kind of like more of a 7-goal performance. And of those, 3 of them were men up. So they really only scored 4 goals in settled 6-on-6 offense. And they committed 18 turnovers. I don't know how many of them were forced and versus uncaused, forced versus unforced. But at the same time, you know, I thought that the first two possessions of the third quarter were really emblematic of how the game went in total, in terms of Michigan scored to cut Duke's lead to 7-4. 2.5 minutes before halftime, and then went into halftime down 3. McNair was covering this game, and you know, he had been doing a bunch of different stuff over the course of the first game, and you know, he had driven up that morning, and was just kind of like, you know, he said, like, I feel locked in now, I am dialed, I get this, and I was like, I hope that Michigan responds, because they also seem like they have been flustered for the first, you know, 30 minutes of this game. But at the same time, I do know that they are capable, talent-wise, and what they have shown over the course of the last 4 or 5 weeks, to go on a flurry and make this competitive down the stretch and whatever else. And on the first two possessions, Ryan Cohen threw the ball out of bounds over the intended target's head. Just unforced, like, bad exchange pass, the type of thing that happens when it's just not your day, your team's not locked in, whatever, whatever. And then on the second possession, I'm not sure who it was, but the Michigan shooter, and this was one of my comments at halftime, it felt like every shot was between 11 and 13 yards, and it needed to be between 9 and 11 in order to be able to beat Wilhelm on that particular day. And that the other possession of the first two possessions was a shot from 13 yards. And, you know, I don't necessarily know that it was settling, and I think that there is a lot of credit that goes to, you know, Duke's defensive personnel in order to force Michigan to take those shots. But, you know, I also thought, I've made no bones about my affinity for Mike Boehm on this podcast over the course of the last 6 weeks. And, you know, he had two opportunities that he typically cans that both got saved. So the first one was he was coming around X front, right-handed, and, you know, he had a step. The slide was going to be late, and he's a lefty. And it looked like either he lost the ball or lost the grip on his stick. And he basically shot the ball directly into Wilhelm's chest. And, you know, again, that is a goal that he typically scores. And then I don't remember the second sequence nearly as well, but I do remember reacting or remarking to those two plays in the context. These are both in the first half, and, you know, it was a 3-goal margin at halftime. Like, you know, those two plays go the other way, and it's a much more competitive game. So I guess, you know, not worth diving too deeply into the nuts and bolts of a 6-goal win that it was very clear Michigan was not going to be able to win from basically the 10-minute mark of the third quarter on. And Duke really separated, you know, turned an 11-7 game into a 15-7 game in a 5-minute span from the 10-minute mark to the 5-minute mark of the fourth quarter. You know, but all that being said, so just the other storyline for Michigan in this one was Ryan Schreiber is their number one LSM. Played more and took a higher percentage of the minutes than arguably any other player on the roster. He was injured during practice this week and missed this game. And so there was going to be that kind of cascading effect in terms of, you know, it wasn't as if they were bumping a close defenseman up to play LSM. They didn't do that. But in terms of, you know, guys that hadn't got as much minutes or as many minutes, like, you know, taking on a greater percentage of the responsibility, it was going to have that effect. And, you know, there were instances in which I saw, like, the Michigan defense that was so good at, you know, reacting and recovering on the rope over the course of this game. But, you know, you already made the points about O'Neal, and there's not much more that needs to be said on that. And then Andrew McAdory had a really good game that wasn't 3 goals in succession to literally determine the outcome of the game, which is what we saw against Delaware. But, you know, that goal-scoring prowess that he demonstrated was an extension, or it felt like it was building on what we had seen previously. So, yeah, I mean, if you're Duke in terms of, you know, turning your attention to Penn State, you got to feel good about that matchup. It's ironic to some extent that Brendan O'Neal committed to Penn State originally, and now he's playing them in a semifinal. Yeah. And then aside from that, you know, because you like your semifinal matchup and because you're going to be familiar with your opponent, certainly you're not going to look past Saturday. But if you're a Duke fan or if you're an analyst looking at what this season means for Duke, like, a national championship is right there for the taking. They have the first semifinal game. We know how impactful that is in terms of the likelihood of winning the national championship game. And, you know, we know that they have the leg up on Virginia all the time and that they have the leg up on Notre Dame in the national championship game historically. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you're Duke, you can start asking for ring sizes, huh?
Yeah. Well, one of the first things that I'll say to that is shut up and I hate you and you're tacky and shut up. and the final point that I'll make is shut up. So, yeah, let's get into some predictions. We got two games.
I think I just did.
I want scores, though, because I just want to nitpick, and I want to be perfect, and I want you to be wrong. I have Notre Dame beating Virginia 14-13 in overtime off of an Eric Dobson lefty shot that goes to the far top right corner. And Duke-Penn State, I have Duke winning 15-11. So the winning team gets 15, and then the losing team goes
something
home.
Less than that.
And my goodness, after you lose a semifinal game, I mean, I think I set the world record for BAC that night. That was a wild night in Philly. But anyways, go ahead.
I'm going to go with the same winners. I'm going to pick Notre Dame over Virginia for a variety of reasons. Emotional. They've already lost twice. Coming off of a comparatively bad game versus a team playing a
comparatively good game. We're best friends, too.
I picked Notre Dame in my pre-tournament bracket. Yeah, that's what I'm going with. Score, yeah, I'm just going to go 13-12. I already laid it out, already made the case. I undercut you Price is Right style. And then Duke.
$1, yeah. Bob.
I think that four-goal margin is probably right. I think it's probably going to be... I feel like Duke's going to... I don't know, it's tough because my argument was going to be, you know, I think that they're going to develop that four-goal lead in the third and fourth quarter, and then they're going to try to slow down the pace. And so as a result, the scoring total is going to be smaller. But that's exactly what they did against Michigan, and then they still got to 15. So, I'll say 14-10. So exactly $1.
What a stupid, you know, well, how about you grow up?
I didn't want to do predictions.
Get your own opinions. Get your own opinions. Those are mine, not yours. You would be a guy that goes $1, Bob, on the Price is Right. But I think you'd do it too early, and then the next guy would say $2. And then you'd be like, but, you know, meh, meh, meh. So, all right, listen, it's the best time of the year.
Enjoy it.
Congrats to everybody on graduating. Have a great Final Four. You're making memories that last a lifetime. If you don't win the ring, you're for sure not going to, you know, you'll get over it, but it's going to be pretty tough. And... Do you have any final words?
This would be a great time to have a Winston Churchill quote right there in the chamber, and I don't have it.
Yeah, you know, if you're going through hell, keep going. That's the only one I can think of. Totally not relevant at all. Terry and I will brush up on some World War II. We'll get History Channel rolling, and we'll come back with insert World War II joke here.
If you like what you heard, which I don't know why you would because that was so inferior to last week's, tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and we'll be back with at least one more episode of the Tailgate Podcast. It won't be next Monday because we won't know who will have won the national championship on Monday morning, unfortunately. So yeah, we'll be back next Tuesday with more Tailgate Podcast.
Love you, Terry.
Love you, Nick.